Today we discuss support for Syrian refugees and how some in Illinois are handling the post-election climate, like Aurora resident Cody Lawrence, who visited a Syrian family in his town after the election.
They offered to teach me Arabic. They offered to teach me how to make Syrian coffee. And, I left the encounter richer and having received more than I gave.
Plus, we'll hear from organizers behind Girl Radio Inc. That's a youth media outlet working with girls in the Champaign-Urbana area to introduce them to radio. And for music this Friday, the Chicago band Laverne talks to us about how one of the most cost-effective ways to release music today is actually through an old friend, a cassette tape.
It feels more like you're not going to lose a lot of money on a cassette. And I think with younger people being more broke than, they used to be, they feel like, if I can't buy the record, I'll just buy the tapes. It's only $5.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This past fiscal year, about 12,500 Syrian refugees were resettled in the U.S. More than 700 of those people came here to Illinois. And those who work with refugee resettlement and support groups throughout the state say they've seen a surge in interest in volunteers. Volunteers who say that since the election has ended, they want to support Syrian families, whether that's in their own neighborhoods throughout Illinois or even those who are thousands of miles away. Joining us to explain more on the line from Chicago is Suzanne Akrasahlul. She's the executive director of the Syrian Community Network. Suzanne, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
As we've seen these reports, Suzanne, many organizations that handle refugee resettlement in Illinois saying they've seen an interest after the election. What did you all experience with the Syrian Community Network?
First of all, thank you for having me on your show and to highlight and amplify this story of refugee resettlement here in Illinois and in particular in Chicago. We at the Syrian Community Network have seen a rise in interest in our organization from everyday people. We've had in the fall, we've had about 40 applications that were submitted for volunteer opportunities. But between November and until now, we've had a doubling of that number. We have at least 80 applications waiting to be processed for people who want to support refugees.
Wow. And what kind of work are people? Are people just calling saying they want to volunteer and help? What are you hearing from people?
Well, we have all kinds of people who are looking to do different types of things. Some who want to lead a toy drive. We have a pharmacist actually right now who will be leading a toy drive in a Little Company of Mary and Christ Hospital in Oakland. We have people who are looking to become mentors. Mentoring entails that you become a volunteer, you go through a background check, we do a training for you, and then we facilitate an introduction between you and the family. And then once a week, you go and visit the family for about an hour, half, or 2 hours. You can help the children with homework. You can help the adults reading their mail. You can help them pay bills, showing them how to pay bills. You can help the woman with their English skills. So many times the men go to ESL classes, but then the women end up not going because they have smaller children. So this is a good way to empower women in their homes while they learn English. And certainly, I believe the best impact that you can have is helping the children with their homework after school, and where you can, really help change, the way they are in school, how their performance in school, by giving them that one-on-one attention.
And I imagine the people who are volunteering, do they speak Arabic? These are people you don't need to speak Arabic. What kind of language skills do you need to help volunteer?
Yeah, that's an amazing question, actually. It's really funny because most of our volunteers do not speak Arabic. in fact, many of the volunteers will download the apps for the translations. And a lot of times the volunteers themselves will be communicating with the children, and the children will be translating.
The children will translate,
so in a way, sure. Mm-hmm. Yes, and in a way, it forces the children also to use their skills, to tell mom or dad, this is what the volunteer was saying. So it helps them, it helps improve their conversation. And then the parents will pick up on a few words here and there. And the best part of, being a mentor is that you become a friend to this family. You help show them around. You can take them to the market. You can take them shopping if you need to. You can bake with them. We have one volunteer who every week who goes into this one family's home, and she brings a recipe for muffins or cookies or something, and she bakes with the children. And what a great way for them, for the children to, you know, not only learn a new skill, but also to read ingredients and to, and she's engaging with them on two tablespoons. This is what a tablespoon looks like. But, you know, this is, and it's she's giving back in a way that's so, it's so, in such a simple way that it's so meaningful for the children. And you don't know where these, you know, these skills will take you in the future.
Susan, what kind of work have you focused on for the Syrian Community Network, particularly over the past 12 months?
So in the last 12 months, we've had a surge in the numbers of families that were coming into Chicago. Between January of 2015 until, you know, I would say May of 2016, we had a steady stream of families coming in, resettling. We only had 25 families, actually. But then between June and until the end of September, because of President Obama's pledge to take on 10,000 refugees across the U.S., so there was a surge in numbers, and it became a little bit quite overwhelming because you had to deal with finding apartments and helping people with jobs. And it was, you know, that, and most of that is done through the resettlement agencies. But what our organization does, we are what you would consider as a mutual aid association, which is like a partner to the resettlement agency. We provide the ethnic and linguistic and cultural component to the work, to the services that the refugees need. We help in translation. We help them with transportation. We connect the families to the community. A lot of times, the families don't know where to go and who are the community members that they should be reaching out to. So that's kind of our role. And something that we started in addition to the mentorship program is that we started a safe space program for the children, where, you know, once a month we will get together with the families, with the children who are, you know, preteens and teenagers, and we help them, you know, we discuss different topics of, you know, body image or bullying or social media or those types of programs, those types of issues that our young teenagers are dealing with at school. I mean, it's difficult enough, you know, to go into a new school and not knowing the language and the culture. And then on top of it, you have to deal with all the peer pressure that comes along with being in school. And so we're just trying to ease their transition into life here in Chicago.
Suzanne, what did you hear from the different refugee families? I wonder about their reaction after President-elect Trump, after the election, and what they are hearing from people in the community in terms of reaction.
Well, we had some families that say it is what it is. You know, we're okay, we're fine, we're here. You know, it's and those are some of the attitudes of the families who've been here for about a year or a year and a half. So I think they're starting to feel more settled, and they feel like now Chicago is their home. But some of the newer families that came in are kind of anxious because, you know, they were saying, oh, are they going to send us back? What's going to happen to us? And many of these families, they still don't have, you know, have not secured a job, or they're in between jobs, or their work hours are less. So they feel unsettled anyway because of their situation. And then on top of it, you know, with all the rhetoric that was coming out, so they feel a little bit uneasy. But we keep telling them, you know, no, you're here. This is your home. Now you have to work hard and do your best so that you can feel, you know, that you're making a difference. And eventually in time, you will be, you know, successful, and you will, show everyone that, you know, refugees who come to the United States can become a success story.
Suzanne, as we're thinking about this, I wonder if you can just explain really quickly for us, when a family comes in through a refugee resettlement program, these Syrian families, what is it like? How much time do they have to find work? How does that process work?
So let's backtrack a little bit on the notion of refugee resettlement. Many of these families, after they have been in Syria, especially, they have been internally displaced inside of Syria, moving from place to place because of shelling or bombing, what's happening in their neighborhoods, until finally they make it out to a host country, which is usually like Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon or Iraq. So a lot of these families then end up, they sign up with UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and then they start receiving aid from the UNHCR. They do get some living assistance. But if a family looks like they can be eligible for resettlement, in the United States, the UN will reach out to this family and tell them you've been selected to resettle in the U.S. They don't know what city. Are you willing to go and go through the process of resettlement so that you can, go and start a new life elsewhere? And so whether the family, once the family agrees, then they start going through a cultural orientation. They go through a vetting process, a very strict a vetting process that usually lasts between 18 months to 24 months. They are asked all kinds of questions about their background, where they live, what they did, what was their profession, what are they doing now in their host country. And those questions are asked for them over and over and over. And then once they've been approved to come to the U.S., and they go through the medical exams and all these, different types of things that they have to, that they have to go through. Once they come to the U.S., there are federal dollars for them for each family. So each family will receive, depending on the number of individuals in that family, $925 per individual. And so if you have a family of five, that's close to $5,000. And that money will last for about 3 months, and that will cover their first month, their security deposit, their first month's rent, and whatever other additional things that they household goods that they need. And in addition, it will cover maybe the first and second month of rent, or the second or third month's rent, depending on how big and how expensive the rent the apartment is. But a lot of times, the resettlement agencies have sponsors who will prepare the apartment for them, who will bring them, all of their household goods. And then it's our groups after 2 months, after they've been here, we kind of now introduce them to the community. We help secure additional needs that they have, in terms of furnishings or clothing or whatever the case may be. We help secure cars. And then on our end, we also provide rental support, because we know in the first 90 days, it's so overwhelming. Imagine you're coming to learn a new language, a new culture, and you've already escaped war. You are dealing with this trauma of what you went through, experience back home, and then you have to come here and start a new life and secure your children's future. So it's a bit overwhelming. So in addition to after those 90 days, after those 3 months when their federal money runs out, and then we kick in a 6 month rental support of between 25% of or 50% of the rent of the family, depending on the situation of what they have. And then we give them that extra cushion so that they can continue to take English classes, continue to develop themselves. We encourage them to take jobs. The resettlement agencies have a jobs program, and they are encouraged to go through that jobs program where they help them with, maybe some interview skills and things like that. But a lot of times they're placed in entry-level positions, dishwashing at the restaurant or cleaning at the airport or different types of, entry-level jobs. And it's a way to help them, adjust and acclimate to their new environment. But we certainly encourage them to take jobs, because that's the only way that they can be independent.
Right, and then can continue to support themselves. We've been talking to Suzanne Akrasalul. She's Executive Director of the Syrian Community Network. And I wanted to bring someone else in this conversation. As we were reporting out to see how communities in Illinois were reacting post-election, we found a Facebook post from Cordy Lawrence. He posted a picture of a tray and teacups, and he wrote about a refugee family that he visited, saying they didn't ask him for a job or a handout. They only asked for me to receive hospitality from their hands. I came to their house to make them feel welcome in a post-election America, but they could not stop welcoming me. Cody is the president and CEO of Borderless. It's a network of ministries, churches, organizations, businesses around the world, and he's on the line with us from Aurora. Hi, Cody. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
How did you meet this family that you posted on Facebook about?
Well, it was very complicated, actually. I went to the thrift store next to my house, and I just saw this family looking at stuff as I was looking at stuff, and just, cheap stuff that you buy for your household. And they were speaking in Arabic, which I at least could recognize a little bit. And so I just said hi to them in Arabic, which, I mean, most everybody's heard how to say assalamu alaikum. So I just said that. It kind of shocked them. And we just started talking. They didn't speak much English, and I speak almost zero Arabic. So it was a conversation that made use of our Google Translate apps on our cell phones, and but we became friends from that. So it was really a very simple kind of connection.
Yeah, and why for you? What prompted that? Why was it important for you to do that?
I guess I have a little bit of a different perspective. A lot of what Suzanne was saying, I was just really resonating with me as I was when my family, when we began to start working with refugees maybe 10 years ago, our idea was, how can we give back? How can we support people? But the more we got to know families from different parts of the world, the more we realized that they give much more to us than we can ever give to them. So nowadays, I mean, when I meet a refugee family, I kind of go into it with an attitude of, I wonder what I'm going to receive from this relationship. I wonder what kind of richness and wealth they're going to bring to me, to my kids, to my wife. So for me, the prompting is just, oh, wow, this is a Syrian family. I'm so glad they're here in my community. Let me get to know them.
And do you feel like that was a really important thing for you to do, especially after the election?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of rhetoric and a lot of politicians playing on fears and ignorance. And I I live in Aurora, Illinois, which is one of the places that gets a large number of refugees resettled in Illinois. So for me, I don't know what this family's reaction has been, how much they've been following the election and things like that. I just wanted them to hear from an American that you're welcome here. I'm glad that you're here.
Susan, we're about to take a break. So actually, let's do that. We're about to take a break, but we'll continue this conversation with Suzanne Akrasalul. She's executive director of the Syrian Community Network. We've been talking to them about refugees being resettled throughout Illinois, more than 700 that have been here this past year, how they've been received, especially since the election, the surge of interest that the network has received from volunteers. We'll also continue the conversation with Cody Lawrence. Here a little bit more about his story. He's president and CEO of Borderless. That's a network of ministries, churches, and organizations around the world. If you guys can stick around for just a minute, we're going to take a break and we'll continue this conversation. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about Syrian refugees in Illinois post-election with Suzanne Akrasalul. She's the executive director of the Syrian Community Network. She's on the line with us from Chicago. From Aurora, we've been talking to Cody Lawrence, who's president and CEO at Borderless. And I just wanted to ask both of you, both of you work with refugees around the world in your jobs, but it strikes me as we've been having this conversation how much you all have just focused on the friendships and the individual relationships that you all feel like. Suzanne, you were talking about the individual relationships that volunteers develop with different Syrian families. Cody, that's the story you were sharing. And I just wanted to ask both of you about that, how important you just think these individual relationships are to helping people get resettled. Cody?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's everything. I think it's very important to kind of go through that evolution as an individual, where first you go from inhospitality to hospitality, where you decide you're going to be a welcomer of refugees. But there's another step beyond that, where you actually realize that most refugee families, they're not just refugees, you know, they're humans. They're people with experiences and wisdom and much to bring to the table. And once you realize that, then you can actually have an authentic friendship where it's not just I'm teaching English and I'm helping this person with paperwork. All of that is vital and crucial. But realizing they have so much to bring to the table that is going to help me. I mean, this particular family we've talked about, the husband's an agricultural engineer and I work in agriculture as well. And so he has like so much to teach me, actually, that he's experienced in Syria. And his wife is a social worker and she has so much wisdom to give to me. So I think it's vital to realize that these people can become some of my closest friends. And indeed, over the years, many families that have been refugees have become some of our closest friends.
Suzanne?
Yeah, I share the same sentiment. Certainly, every time I go to a family's house when I visit, I feel like, okay, here I come. You know, I'm going to help you, but then I end up being helped. Actually, it keeps me, keeps me grounded, and I start to remember the experiences I had as a child when I first came to this country when I was at the age of 10.
And, from Syria. You came here, right, Susan?
Yes,
right.
I came from Syria. I'm sorry. Yes. My father at that time, you know, had difficulty finding an apartment, and we lived, my sister and I lived in one with a family, and then my parents were living with another family, and so we were separated. And so that, you know, so visiting a refugee family, reminds me of my childhood, and that's kind of why prompted us to start the rental support, because we know that we want to keep families together, we want to make sure that they have a safe home, and to keep them in their home, and that's very important. And every time, you know, I go and visit a family, I feel like I've learned so much. One time I took a board game with me, and I thought, okay, here, I'm going to come and teach them this American board game. I think it was like Life or something like that. I don't remember what it was. But then they pulled out all of their games, and and they taught me some, you know, a few games, the Syrian board games that I used to play as a child. I forgot about them. So that was a really nice experience. And then on top of it, the hospitality and the generosity. My daughter graduated from eighth grade, and my daughter and I went to visit this other family that has a daughter that is also in eighth grade. And, we took a small gift for her, to congratulate her. But then they surprised us with like three gifts for my daughter. And I was so embarrassed. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like the level of generosity and hospitality is just, you know, sometimes overwhelming. And then you leave feeling very humbled, and you leave very inspired to do more, and thinking like, why can't I visit? I wish I could visit more. I wish I lived a little bit closer so I could do more for these families. And then, as Cody said, you know, there's so much wisdom and so much to learn from these families. And sometimes, you know, I cringe to use the word refugee because I don't want to place them in that category, but I don't know what other word to use sometimes. I'll just call them our new friends or our new community members. But then the word comes back again when you're, you know, and having, and, you know, when we're in different conversations. But really, it's just really inspiring to be around these families to learn so much from them.
Well, thank you for taking the time to share your experiences with us, both to Suzanne Akrasalul, who's the executive director of the Syrian Community Network, and to Cody Lorenz, Aurora resident, president and CEO at Borderless. Suzanne, Cody, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to The 21st. This past weekend, a group of young girls in the Champaign-Urbana area got to meet a local band and learn how to make their own music. It's part of a project called Girl Radio, Inc. That's an independent radio show run out of the University of Illinois Women Resource Center, and it teaches girls how to get involved with the media. One of our producers, Sean Newman, went to last weekend's rock camp to hear what the kids came up with. Let's take a listen.
I'm Camila Glowacki. I'm in the band Nectar, and today we hosted a music workshop as part of Girl Radio Camp. The girls get to hear us perform for them and talk about songwriting a little bit. And then we had the girls try out different instruments, and then we ended our workshop with the girls writing their own songs and performing it with us.
My friend once told me the world is macaroni, so I took a bite out of a tree. No, 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 no.
One of the bands they formed was called Black Magic, and they were like, oh, Black Magic should keep writing songs.
My name is Ergie.
My name is Aria.
And my name is Sage, and
our band name is Black Magic.
We got each other's emails so we can, like, try and make new songs, because it was really fun. Even though we knew the song already, we had to teach our other person.
So it seems like this was, to me, it's successful because not only did they have fun, but they're looking forward to hopefully writing more songs and doing stuff like this in the future.
So That's a little bit of Girl Radio, Inc. One of the organizers behind Girl Radio is in studio with us now, Rachel Storm. She's an assistant director also at the Women's Resource Center. Also with us is Ron Castor, who helps produce and record each program. Rachel, Ron, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
So it's great to hear a little bit of that audio so we have a sense of what you are doing, Rachel. How did the girls respond to being around the instruments and the amplifiers and having that musical time?
They absolutely loved it. We have had youth programming on the radio before that has incorporated music making, but to date, Girl Radio hadn't had a workshop specifically focused on making music and on them getting to test out instruments and meet a local band and also hear about what it takes to make a band. So I think the girls are really excited about that.
Ron, and I see you're nodding your head. We heard a little bit of how that process unfolded, but what did the girls do during the whole weekend camp?
Oh, my gosh. I think we had 12 different segments over the course of 2 days. And those segments ranged everything from dramatic renditions about different kinds of problems that girls had to the music workshop to superhero, a workshop on superheroes and creating their own superheroes where they were able to make some drawings and write some stories and then present.
Age are they? And what age are these young women?
So these are all girls between 9 and 13 years old.
Mm-hmm. And what made you want to start doing this?
So about nearly a little over 5 years ago, I started a youth radio program called Out of the Mouths of Babes. And that's a summer program. It's about 12 weeks long.
And those kids are even younger.
They're even younger. So they're between 5 and 10 years old. It's a really wide age range, but it's a lot of fun. It's more field trip based. So it's every Saturday in the summer for almost the entirety of their summer vacation. And we spend a lot of time taking them to arts and cultural programming in Champaign-Urbana and having them kind of review them on the radio. It's not a live show, so it's pre-recorded. Girl Radio is the same way. Girl Radio really began when a lot of the participants of Out of the Mouths of Babes, majority of them were girls, started aging out of the program. And so they wanted their own radio show. And we decided maybe this would be a really great opportunity to make a more girl-focused program. That would actually not only train them in how to make their own radio program and production, but would also give them a space to talk about issues that girls face and the unique experiences that they have related to a lot of the issues that come up around their age range.
And Ron, do you feel like a lot of this is about helping these young women, these girls, find their voice? Is it just really about them giving them instruments to do that?
Oh, definitely so. I mean, over the course of the 2 days, you can see their confidence really go up. And one of the indications of that is that when they start talking to each other at first, it's always about they're eager to offer their opinion. But as things go along, they'll say things like amplifying on what she said or adding to what somebody else in the group said. And it really becomes a kind of conversation.
Mm-hmm. And can you remind us where these, once you put these programs together, where do you air them?
Absolutely. So Girl Radio, just like Out of the Mouths of Babes, airs on WRFU 104.5, which is our low power radio station based out of the Independent
Media
Center.
Right. So just if you're in the Champaign-Urbana, just in that area, you can hear it. Is it also, is there a chance?
It is. It's online. So you can also find it on SoundCloud.com. We are SoundCloud. It's Girl Radio, Inc. on SoundCloud. We also have Girl Radio, Inc. as a Facebook page where we post every new episode there so they can listen to the podcasts on our social media accounts, too.
And we'll tweet all of that out from our social media. So if you follow 21st Show on Twitter, 21ST Show, you can see the links to some of these things that the girls are producing. Rachel, what's the target audience for the show? Are you trying to get other kids interested in things? Is it for parents?
So we say it's for girls by girls, but at the same time that we want a much broader audience, because one of the things that's true is that we rarely, if ever, hear girl voices on the radio. We hardly ever hear youth voices on the radio, but we particularly don't hear girls talking about genuine experiences that they're having, some that are positive, some that are negative, but nonetheless that are, you know, formulate their experiences as young girls. So that's one of the real goals, is to also be able to kind of speak back to adult populations, to be able to speak back to the media in general, and to be able to tell girls' stories from their perspectives.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, when we're thinking about, there was one of the young women we were hearing, Aria, we heard her singing. She started in Out of the Mouths of Babes, and then she graduated to Girl Radio. Ron, is that the case? Are you seeing a lot of the kids who start with the younger, do they want to stay active with making media? There's some kids who maybe just love it and want to keep doing it.
Oh, definitely so. So we just had the second season of Girl Radio, and many of the people who were there started in the first season. And you can see that maturity over time. Some of the girls that we've been working with, we've been working now for 4 or 5 years. And it's wonderful to see them develop not only their own voice, but also really strong opinions about the media, about what they like about the media, and really taking a more active role in how we put together the radio programs.
What do they say about what kind of things do what or what kind of things are you hearing them say?
So one of the really profound things, especially from the first season, has to do with media depictions of girls. And it's interesting where this starts. It starts by sort of likes and dislikes in terms of maybe magazine covers, songs, that sort of thing. But then as the girls talk to each other, you can hear their critique of the media being refined. Like, why is the girl being presented this way? Why is she being dressed this way? Why is this sort of computer enhancement taking place on her skin tone? And this leads to all sorts of sort of political topics. And they're eager to talk about those things.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel, do you find that are you deliberately, I wonder how you sort of are shaping, helping them have a critical voice and think about, as you know, Ron's saying, they're sort of analyzing and breaking down mm-hmm. all these different media depictions of women and girls. How are you helping them kind of sort all of that out?
Well, because this is kind of recorded over a 2-day period, we have workshops throughout the day, and the workshops invite different kinds of content. So we do deliberately try to bring up different kinds of content. So one, for example, season one had an episode where we were giving them magazines that target their age population, so like young girl magazines, and we were having them analyze the covers of magazines for the kinds of messaging the media is sending to young girls. So they were critically analyzing them in groups, and then we invited them to remake in your group a magazine that you felt sent a more positive message. And so they recreated all these magazines. I was remembering one of them was Teen Vogue magazine, and they recreated it to be called Teen Voice. And it was about giving voice to girls. And so they started talking about all the ways in which, you know, these magazines largely focused on body image and appearance as one of the most valuable things that girls should be invested in. And then they were kind of talking about, you know, that's very limiting, and we want to talk more about what other things girls should be promoted to do. So they talked about, for instance, the experience of girls often being expected to sort of hide their knowledge, or that being smart is not cool for a girl. And so instead their magazine read things like, how to get all A's in math this year, like you're going to rock it, you know, like all these sorts of great messages for young girls to hear. And I think that was really fun. Yeah, exactly.
And I wonder, we've been talking about media, sort of mass media. I wonder how much you are also discussing with them news literacy. And I'm mm-hmm. thinking in particular of all of the research that we've seen lately about young people, middle schoolers, so maybe a little bit younger than, a little older than this age, but the ability to even distinguish between what's news and what's journalism and what isn't. Do you guys talk about that?
That's a great topic. I think we've only very minimally touched upon literacy in general, and I think that's something that I really want to explore more in the next season. One of our volunteers with Girl Radio, who's been involved with Out of the Mouths of Babes as well, is Dominique Arnold, and she's the librarian at University Laboratory High School. Dominique does a lot of work around literacy of the media as a librarian, and being able to distinguish between opinion and peer-reviewed information. And I think it would be great to incorporate that next season.
One last question for you guys. We just have about a minute left, but I wonder, what have you learned from these girls doing Girl Radio? Ron? Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last workshop series, some of the things that I learned come from surprises that take place. So over the course of the day, occasionally we'll give the girls a chance to sort of do what they want, you know, have some snacks and do what they want. At one point, one of the girls said, I think I want to do some meditation. And at first it was said sort of seriously, but also sort of jokingly. And then pretty soon the whole group decided they wanted to meditate too. And so here we had a group of 9 to 12-year-old girls sitting down in a room by themselves, meditating and chilling out for 10 minutes. and then they came back later in the day and said, can we meditate some more? It was just the most amazing kind of self-organizing community among these kids. Yeah,
that's great. So you can, again, as I said, we'll tweet out all of the links to episodes from Girl Radio if you want to listen online. Find them on SoundCloud. I want to thank producer Ron Castor, organizer Rachel Storm for joining me. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, stay tuned. We'll be talking to the Chicago band Laverne about how they produce music and how they're releasing it. It's an interesting thing, not by radio, but mostly also by cassette tape. You're listening to The 21st. Nyla Boodoo. That was This World from the Chicago band Laverne. They're playing at the Empty Bottle in Chicago this Sunday night. They're with us now to talk a little bit more about their music. With us is Sam Brown, hey, and Corey Clifford.
Hey,
hey guys, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So we just heard a little tiny bit, a taste of your music right there, and I really feel like it's kind of gives us a feel of like 90s pop rock. So it's 2016. Where did you guys find yourself making music that sounds a lot like bands that were super popular a couple decades ago? You guys feel like it's, do you feel like your music is a little throwback to that era? What do you think?
Maybe a little bit. I think we're like all kind of like true indie rockers at heart. And we like, I don't know. I think like everything from like bigger stuff like on Matador to lesser known stuff like on Sarah Records or different 90s twee and shoegaze, I've always really enjoyed. But I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's funny because actually that song I totally like, I think I was listening to like a lot of like Benny King and like Dionne Warwick when I wrote it.
Oh, interesting.
You know, I mean,
okay.
But I think, like, I think maybe vocally, like, it's a bit more 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sam, how did you get involved in Laverne?
Well, I had heard Pine Box when they were first happening. And I was really impressed by Corey's songwriting and especially his like potential as a frontman. Just, you know, he really captivates an audience and just knows how to control a crowd. He just writes these simple pop melodies that are super catchy. You know, I hadn't really heard his songs before and was really impressed by it. And when I heard that Pine Box was broken up, I was like, well, Corey, I'm sure he still has a ton of songs and we need to start a band together. I had been playing drums for 15 or 20 years and knew that it would be a good fit. A lot of the songs that Corey was writing reminded me of stuff that I liked from Elvis Costello and Big Star. And I thought it would be really fun to try and start a band with Corey, like similar sense to Pine Box, but you know, I've got a lot of technique to fall back on, and the other people we're playing with really know their instruments. And we could just kind of like take that Pine Box feel and bring it up to the next level.
So we've been talking about your music. Let's hear some of it. We've been talking to Sam Brown and Corey Clifford, both of them with the Chicago band Laverne. Let's take a listen to a song from your self-titled record that was released earlier this year. This one's called Needs That I Need.
I promise you that I'm
right, that's Needs That I Need from the Chicago band Laverne. They're playing this Sunday night at the Empty Bottle in Chicago. I'm talking to Sam Brown and Corey Clifford from Laverne. Hey, so I've got a question for you guys. Corey, the current guitarist, Ed McMenamin, put out a cassette tape. I know a Pinebox cassette tape through his label Dumpster Tapes. I wonder for you guys what it's like in the digital age. Why do you feel like you guys are, both of you, Laverne now, still releasing music on cassette tapes?
I think, like, in the modern age, it's just so hard to push things when it comes to, like, a small release. So I think with cassettes, it's a bit more, it feels more like you're not going to lose a lot of money on a cassette. And I think with younger people being more broke than, you know, they used to be, at least, you know, in the, like, urban setting, they feel like, well, you know, if I can't buy the record, I'll just buy the tapes, and it's only $5.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of the venues we play at are, like, cash only anyway, so they're like, well, I could buy a tape or buy, like, two more shots of whiskey. And I think, you know,
hopefully they go for the tape.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, like, fun novelty with having a cassette as opposed to just like putting a release out on CD.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Cassette player, and it's like it's like more of a tactile, physical thing. Just like buying a record, you know, you have some investment if you actually have a tape player to spin it on. Or
yeah, I'm going to get to that in a second. Player. The tape player thing. Can I ask you though? Because it sounds like you guys and Sam, do you feel like something's missing when a band is just releasing something digitally?
Yeah, kind of, because you don't have that, like, take-home memento that you'd want for to, like, remember a band. You feel like you have an investment in a band when you have something physical from them, and whereas CDs is all digital, you know, everybody gives away digital download codes with any physical media they're releasing.
If I may interject, there's like a really good Ian Svenonius article on like stuff versus like the kind of like modern Appleization of like media and culture. And I think like what's cool is you can tell there's still like enough people who want to have stuff. And then there's still, like, the people out there who, you know, they want everything compressed on one thing.
So you have to do both, sort of, right? Like, do you guys feel like you have to do both? And it's also...
Definitely.
Yeah. Corey, it's also cheaper, right? It's like when you're, instead of thinking about vinyl production, which I imagine can be pretty expensive, a cassette tape is a lot less investment on you guys' part, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So let me ask you, I know some of you guys actually live together. Are you guys always surrounded by music all day?
Yeah.
How does that go? Do you guys get sick of it?
So. No, not really.
I mean,
the only music I get sick of is like, so I'll like drive a lot, and XRT in Chicago will play like all those songs that have like the, you know, like the really bad new alternative rock.
Wow, you're totally slamming XRT right now.
I know, I feel bad, but like XRT I grew up on, and they used to just play so much variety, and they got bought by CBS, and that's just how it goes, you know? So,
what do you guys do to keep a healthy balance and make sure that the band stays interesting with this time that you guys spend together?
I think like what's good is we're all pretty good at constructive criticism. But I think more importantly is we're always kind of like bouncing different ideas or like different sounds off of each other. And I think developing that is a really good idea. I think the fact that we're always showing each other different types of music or different recordings is always a good thing too. So.
Yeah, we all listen to a pretty eclectic mix of music, and, you know, the songs Corey's writing often reflect, like, what he's currently listening to, or what he's particularly interested in, and like the drum parts all right will follow the same kind of pattern. The newer songs we're writing always have kind of like a compilation of like what everyone's been listening to or into currently, or at least pull from those ideas.
You guys are recording a new album right now. Do you feel like each album that you do, you kind of have an evolution of working together and playing together, so that, I don't know if you think that makes it easier or harder the further you guys go along?
I don't know. I think it makes it, like, it's like a bigger challenge as we go forward, but I think it actually makes it easier to, like, develop a sound, since we already, like, know each other and we've already been through this, but, like, this time around, I think it's, like, it's been technically, like, a little bit easier because of the fact that we're kind of, like, all expecting, like, bigger things out of ourselves, and we're like, yeah, you know, like, we've been playing really good shows. People like the first record. Now we can make this next record even better, you know?
So yeah.
Another thing that's helped vary our sound on this new record is we're working with a new bass player, Kinsey Ring, who joined the band in September. He's a very technical player that has a really great musical sensibility, and the bass parts he's writing stand out front a lot more than some of our old bass parts when Michael Santana was our main bass player. So a lot of the newer stuff has a little more of a groovy vibe, or there are more like obvious bass fills and solos, and that's been another thing that's kind of mixed up our sound on this newer album.
Great. Well, thanks. So before we go out, you can catch Laverne in Chicago on Sunday at the Empty Bottle. That show's at 9:00. I want to thank Sam Brown and Corey Clifford for being with me. Hey, thanks, guys.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
And this is a sad, sad chat by Laverne. That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.